Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 87 of the show, a Baseball America podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Ben Badler. Ben, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm great, Carlos. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Like we were saying before we started the show, it feels like if you miss a week in baseball season, it feels more like you missed an entire month. But yeah. Happy to know that Charlie Condon is still busy homering once every game or close to that rate. But yeah, how have things been in my week of absence?
Yeah, do you think Charlie Condon gets to 40 home runs this year? I was thinking that earlier in the year, and I was like, that seems like a crazy statement to make that we could have a college baseball hitter today hitting 40 home runs, but he's at 33 through 47 games. We're recording this on May 8th, so like there's still more season to go. SEC tournament, postseason after that. I think he might do it.
Yeah, I was reading a piece that Teddy had earlier this week, just his roundup of weekend action, and he looked into Condon's pace, and he basically said if he maintained his current pace, which at this point there's no real reason for me to assume he's not going to do that, he would only need 10 or 11 games to do it. He's at 33 homers right now. I think it's like 0.7 homers per game. So they basically just need a win in the SEC tournament or the NCAA postseason, I think, to get the required amount of games. So right now, I think I would lean towards, yeah, he's going to get there. But I also wonder, too, I mean, it probably just makes sense for teams to start walking him much more frequently, especially once the games start to matter. Like, he's slugging over 1,000. So putting him on base at first base, intentionally walking him, is quite literally like more advantageous for your team at this stage.
Well, Vanderbilt walked him. He led off the third inning in a weekend game last weekend, and they intentionally walked him as the leadoff hitter in the third inning. Not even like, obviously, they look like late, close situation, definitely put him on, but they're just like, no, third inning, leadoff hitter, just give you literally a free base to open the inning.
I mean, there are some other interesting hitters in that lineup. Corey Collins in particular has been pretty good this year, but there's got to be no hitter in the country you'd rather not face than Charlie Condon at this stage. So if teams are just going to give him the Barry Bonds treatment at this point, I really don't think it's a terrible strategy. And I mean, his walk rate is only 17% right now. I mean, part of that is just because he's not the Nick Kurtz type of hitter who just never expands the zone. But
are you including the intentional walks in that? Because he has 18 of his 41 walks are intentional walks.
Do you know if walk... Let me actually do the math on that really quickly. I'm not sure if all of these are lumped into the walk rate that I'm looking at right now, but I guess I can just pull up his Georgia.
So the unintentional walk rate would be 9.7%.
Okay, so that's getting closer to that elite sort of walk rate, I would imagine. Do you know if intentional walks, they should just be counted in your overall walks, right?
Right. So yeah, so he has 41 overall walks this year. And gotcha. Then,
so you're saying 9% of the 17% are intentional walks? That actually is...
Well, no, sorry. 9.7% are unintentional walks. So him working the count, getting on base that way, as opposed to the other, the rest of the walks, the other...
I would say that's like lower than I would expect for a player like him, but also... I would want to be swinging the bat constantly.
He's also, I mean, you're right. He's not the Nick Kurtz patient bordering on passive approach, right? He's not him. He's not Emmanuel Rodriguez with the Twins, right? But he also isn't swinging and missing much. Like, I don't even know how many deep counts he's even getting himself into where, like, he's not even mishitting balls. It's, I mean, He almost has more home runs. He has 33 home runs and he has 35 strikeouts. That is insane. Like, if you have more extra base hits than strikeouts, that is a great sign that you have a great mix of contact and impact. The fact that your home runs are almost equal to your strikeouts is mind-blowing.
It's also funny, too, because at least a few weeks ago, I was looking at Jack Caglione's extra base damage, and he only had – this was 2 weeks ago. I'm not sure exactly what he has now. I'll pull it up as I'm talking about it. But he had – I think like mid-20s home runs and just two doubles, no triples. So like if Caglione was hitting an extra base hit, it was a home run or nothing basically. Yeah. And just pulling it up right now, Yeah, he has 20 still only two doubles. So 27 homers and just two doubles in 48 games. That is also kind of a wonky stat for me when we're looking at some of these college hitters. Maybe Jack just hits the ball too hard and too far to get measly little doubles. It's home run or nothing for him. So that was an interesting one.
And he's not really striking out this year either.
Yeah.
I mean, last year it was 18%. This year it's, I mean, half that. I think it's 7 or 8%.
Yeah, it's 7.6% right now. It's basically less than half that. The walk rate is more than doubled. So those significant plate discipline numbers, I think, are going to be really encouraging for him. And, you know, I kind of expected the home run race to heating up a little bit more. And it really feels like Connor is kind of running away with it at this stage. Do you think anyone is going to be able to challenge him at this stage or no?
I mean, unless he gets hurt, I don't see anybody catching him. I mean, Travis Bazana has 26 home runs at Oregon State too. I mean, Brayden Montgomery's up there, but
yeah, right now it's Condon at 33, Caglione at 27, Lyle Miller Green at Austin Peay. That entire team is just going ballistic. He has 27, and then, like you said, Travis Bazana, 26. But yeah, I didn't really expect a six homer gap. It really felt like maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, Condon, Cags, Montgomery, Bazana were kind of tightening that race, and Condon has just been pretty insane lately.
Yeah, but no, I think new top 100 too on the on the site.
Yeah, how was the process for updating? It's typically a meeting I'm more involved in. This was our first big kind of in-season adjustment of the year, top 100, updated top 30s. How did that process go with the team? And I was kind of just away and living vicariously through you guys, seeing all the updates on the site. I mean, kind of had some insight as to who was going to be moving around, but how do you think the process went this year in our first update?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, we're not starting from scratch and building an entirely new top 100, but there is a lot of, I think there's a lot of actionable information that we're getting both from scouting looks at players, the performance data, some of the other metrics that we have access to as well, to be able to update our priors on these players and adjust our forecast accordingly and move players around. And yeah, I mean, it's the first month of the season plus, you know, spring training as well. So it's still relatively, it's not the same as a, you know, a mid-season or an end of the season update. But I think there still is a lot of actionable information for you to be able to adjust your projections for these players and move players around, whether it's smaller adjustments, like moving, say, like James Wood up a little bit to number five and making him number one prospect in the national system, or for other players where there were bigger jumps, like a Jefferson Rojas with the Cubs, who moved significantly up the list, or falls down and or out of the list. So, but at the same time, look, there's still contextual factors, guys who are playing maybe in a cold weather league, especially in A-ball for the first time in their lives, especially like the, you know, Latin American players who are out there wearing like you know, face masks and all bundled up, can't feel their hands trying to hit. So, you know, there are circumstances like that where you have to just keep all the context in mind or as much as you can. But at the same time, yeah, I think there's a lot of information we can take away that is meaningful to be able to move players around at this point already.
Yeah, James Wood moves up as the top player in the national system, number five overall in the top 100, only a few weeks after he was on our new hot sheet show on YouTube. So I guess if you come on the show, you got a good chance to move up on the list. Is that what we're saying, Ben?
Do you think you have maybe the correlation, causation, the causality backwards, perhaps?
We're basically bribing players to come onto our show with better rankings at this stage, I think, right?
Oh, because he was on the show, therefore we juiced him up the rankings.
Exactly, yeah. So,
I thought you meant going on the show allowed him to play the way he has.
No. So which were the players that maybe led to the biggest battles when we were talking about moving on the list? Were there any polarizing players, guys that Maybe some people on staff are more hesitant to move them up for whatever reason. Maybe people picking into certain pieces of that context that you were mentioning, and others maybe feeling like the changes that we've seen so far this year were more meaningful, or maybe just any specific players who are most fascinating in this update. There are a lot of notable movers we can pick out and point to and maybe talk through briefly. And you also have all that information on the website right now, I believe, as well. So, yeah, I guess just what was the most fascinating piece to start off with our top 100?
For polarizing players? It's a good question. I mean, we moved Ricky Tiedemann down quite a bit, obviously, with the injuries and still struggling to throw strikes. I don't think there was any disagreement that he needed to move down, but maybe a disagreement on how much to move down. I can tell you I would have, you know, we moved him down to 55.
Yep.
So I think it's probably
a spot jump, yeah, which is significant. It would be one of the more significant down arrow moves on this board.
Yeah, and it's probably more a difference of, okay, I probably would have had him more in that range, if not maybe a little bit lower, to start the year.
Exactly. So you have him in your mind started out like around 50, and you want to lower him probably further, whereas other people were more towards the highest range. And so it feels like even more aggressive to them.
Yeah, but yeah, that would be one of them. But again, everybody, I think, agreed. Yeah, he needs to come down, just given the injury concerns.
Well, I also noticed too that the biggest down arrow player on this list was my guy Dylan Lesko. He drops from 38 to 88, about a 50 spot drop down the board, just continuing to not find the strike zone and walking. I think he's walking more than 11 batters per nine right now, which is obviously a pretty terrible rate. So that kind of hurt me. That hit me a little bit, but it makes sense to fall. And I imagine if he doesn't kind of turn things around or show some improvement or give people some confidence, he might not be long for this world on the top 100.
Yeah, on the top 100. That's it's a rough start for him. So it's probably just should have had him lower coming into the year. So maybe it feels like a steeper drop.
A few podcasts ago, I talked about how entering the year, I was maybe a little bit worried that I was too conservative with Dylan Lesko, and through no smarts on my end, it's looking better than I expected it to. Just, I didn't expect him to throw this erratically as far away from TJ as he is. But I guess that is maybe one saving grace for me, penalizing some of these injured pitchers, because I'm kind of like with you on Ricky Tiedemann. I think I was a bit lower on him than where he wound up on our board. Obviously don't want to see players get hurt, but I don't know what is more concerning for you, a situation with Tiedemann where you're just not on the field and you have these lingering injury issues, or a situation with Lesko where you are in the field and the performance is just really bad?
Well, and he does have TJ in his history too. So
the performance is related to the injury, I would imagine. Well, he just hasn't looked like the same pitcher since the injury. So maybe I don't know how much you can expect him to, like, will he ever be that sort of 70 command type guy again? Maybe you're projecting on that and you always were, but it's certainly very, very far off from any loud grade like that.
Yeah, I would say right now there's greater concern for me with Lesko. I mean, Tiedemann has at least shown, when he has been healthy, like flashes of success. Like, I still think he's more of a reliever who belongs more in like the mold of like a DL Hall when he was a prospect, who also probably was going to be a reliever most likely long term, and I think probably still is. You know, somebody like that, or Nate Pierce, another guy who just struggled to stay healthy. So I think not ruling off starting entirely for Tiedemann, but I think that's pretty much what all the evidence and indicators are pointing to right now with him as the highest probability. Whereas with Lesko, yeah, I mean, you do have the TJ already. He's come back, and I mean, we can sometimes take for granted that players don't always come back the same as they were for TJ prior to the operation. It obviously is a very good track record, but I mean, you think of there's certainly guys who haven't returned to the form they were before. I mean, Brady Aiken, obviously, very famously, or certainly other examples like that too. But I mean, we've seen stuff still there from Dylan Lesko, but whereas last year you were thinking, all right, well, you know, it's only what 33 innings that he threw last year. It's his first year coming back from TJ. We expect, or we understand a lot of times that maybe command control won't be there right away when a player comes back. So give it a little more time. And, you know, again, it's only a month into the season, but it's a pretty rough outcome so far when you're giving up more than a run and more than a walk per inning so far.
Yeah, it's 5 starts, 15.1 innings, 9.39 ERA, 17 strikeouts and 20 walks. It's a 10 strikeout per nine, 11.7 walk per nine numbers. Pretty unfortunate for my guy, Dylan Lesko. I'm praying he has the Mackenzie Gore experience where it looks a little dicey for a while and he eventually figures it out.
That's yeah, that could be.
At this point. All right, who else? Who else was interesting? I mean, we don't have to only talk about the down arrow players. Those were two of the more prominent fallers on this list that I saw after seeing the moves. Any other guys you want to mention here?
Yeah, we bumped up Christian Scott with the Mets quite a bit. You know, we had him toward the back of the top 100 already. I don't think he had come up yet before we moved him up on this list. I think he made his debut in the major leagues after that, if I remember right. But just comparing him to some of the other pitchers who were higher up the list, like, yeah, I mean, he's older than a lot of them, but he's also in AAA dominating and has, I mean, he has a lot of starter traits. I mean, he throws a lot of strikes. He's sitting mid-90s with his fastball. It plays up because of the ride, the extension that he gets. So you see he gets a lot of swing and miss when he pitches up in the zone with a fastball, a slider. He can manipulate that. It has power with it into the upper 80s, so he can throw it as that, you know, lateral break, sweeping away from hitters or sweeping away from right-handed hitters. He can use it, get more depth to throw it to lefties as well, get swing and miss there. He's got that, I think it's like a split changeup that he throws too. Yep. Some pretty heavy tumbling action to get swing and miss down in the strike zone too, or another pitch that can get swing and miss down along with a slider. Complement that with the fastball up to get empty swings. So, I mean, to me, he looks like right now somebody who could be a very dependable number three type starter. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some upsides, maybe be a number two even.
Yeah, he moves from 93 to 62 on the board. It's a 31 spot jump. He pitched for the Mets on May 4th against the Rays, 6.2 innings, 6 strikeouts, 1 walk, 5 hits and an earned run allowed. Like you said, threw a lot of strikes. And he's just been good. He is about to be 25 years old in June. But it does feel like maybe with pitchers especially, you could be more confident in either jumping them or lowering them significantly. Like the changes that a pitcher has made, either just visually or with the numbers you can look at, I feel like you can be more aggressive in how quickly you're swinging them, even if it is early in the season. With a lot of these guys, you have a number of starts. You can see the stuff. You can see the feel. You can see in the data if there are significant changes to how their pitches are moving or getting results. Whereas with hitters, because it's reactive, there are a lot of thresholds you maybe have to wait for before you can feel good about a sample, even if maybe you can see notable jumps with tools or physicality or a swing change or something like that. But it maybe is not surprising that a lot of these biggest movers we're talking about up and down have been arms.
Yeah, I mean, like you compare Christian Scott to some of the arms we have behind him now, whether it's like an A.J. Smith-Shawver or Hurston Waldrop with the Braves, Noble Meyer with the Marlins, Takoa Robey with the Cardinals. I mean, those are good arms too. I mean, I really like Noble Meyer still, but, you know, like Smith-Shawver is struggling right now in AAA, Waldrop kind of the same in AA, and those guys are still on our top 100, but it'd be hard for me to take any of those guys right now ahead of Scott, who's based on the way he's pitching, the way the stuff's looked, the strikes, everything in AAA, and then him obviously now doing it in the big leagues. It's, mm-hmm. you know, that's what some of those guys, I think, are what he's doing right now is what some of those guys aspire to be.
Yeah, what Christian Scott is doing right now is like the upside that I had in mind for AJ Smith-Shawver. And like you said, he's struggling and Christian Scott's doing it. So it makes perfect sense to get those players in the right order. That's the whole point of this. Let's see here. The other maybe most prominent riser that I feel like we have to touch on here is Jared Jones. I mean, he jumps from 24 into 8. I guess Jared must have been he was probably a pretty significant riser on our preseason top 100 just based on his loud spring training. But any thoughts on him being now the number two prospect in baseball behind Paul Skeens? And I guess thoughts on Paul Skeens versus Jared Jones? I mean, obviously one of them is doing it at the major league level. I don't think either of us believe that Paul Skeens couldn't be doing it at the major league level if he was given the opportunity. But how close do you view these two pitchers?
Yeah, I don't even think there's I would say a case, but it would be hard for me to put anyone other than Paul Skeens ahead of Jared Jones right now, who's, you know, still technically prospect eligible just because he doesn't have the 50 innings in the big leagues yet. But I mean, I love Jackson Jobe. I think he has all the attributes to be a number one starter. I think Jared Jones right now is pitching in the big leagues like a number one starter. I mean, he not only is going to be a pretty strong contender for Rookie of the Year, but he looks like somebody who might be in the NL Cy Young race this year. He's been that good. The swinging strikes that he's getting have been tremendous. It's an outstanding fastball, and I think the slider's really taken a step forward this year. It's become a true wipeout pitch for him. So those two pitches, the athleticism that he has, the strikes that he's been able to throw this year, Andrew Painter we have high, and maybe I'd be a little bit lower on Painter just given that, you know, the injury and how much time he's going to miss. I mean, when he was healthy, he certainly looked like a guy who could be a number one type starter, but like, I don't know who else would go, like Cade Horton. I really like Cade Horton, but he's just not as good as Jones is right now or doing what Jones is at the varsity level right now. So, it'd be hard for me to even build a case for anyone other than maybe Jackson Jobe if you really want to go in on Jobe. But other than Skeens, who I think maybe does have just as good, if not better stuff than Jones and is, you know, still, I guess, for now, just going to hang out in AAA for maybe another start or two or something, but doesn't seem to be like that level is any struggle for him.
Yeah. Jones has been tremendous. It's 7 starts, 41 innings, a 2.63 ERA. He should graduate from prospect status with 2 more starts. If all goes well, he leads all starting pitchers in baseball with an 18.7% strikeout rate. And to your point about Jackson Jobe versus Jared Jones, he is right now pitching like maybe you could project Jackson Jobe, like you could project him to be at the major league level, but it's hard to not just take the guy who right now has the sort of pitch mix and stuff and performance at that level. You don't need to project. He's doing it, like you said. It's kind of crazy to think of him being in the Cy Young race, but he has certainly been good enough to warrant that. I'm just seeing now where he ranks in terms of all pitchers in baseball. We're like pitcher F4, not quite as loud as I would have expected. I think his maybe home run rate is a little bit higher that may be dinging him, but the actual runs he's allowed and the strikeouts and the swing and miss stuff at the major league level has been super impressive. So nice to see him get a healthy jump. And I can't imagine Pirates fans are too bummed about having Jones. And then hopefully, I don't know at what point Skeens is going to be up, but at some point soon, he should be giving them 2 ace-like or ace potential arms in the same rotation, which I don't know. When's the last time Pittsburgh can claim something like that?
It'll be a good anchor of the rotation. I think their lineup still needs quite a bit of help from at least on the younger player side. It's been the farm system is definitely tilted toward the pitching side, and then you look at their lineup right now and it's just like, oh, yeah. I mean, hopefully O'Neill Cruz can take another or can take a step forward, but otherwise that lineup, I mean, Brian Reynolds has been solid, but otherwise that whole lineup's been pretty rough to watch. Obviously Henry Davis struggling.
You don't
quite
like
a
Connor
bit.
Joe.
Yeah, he's been nice. Off to a nice start, but
yeah, I think
look up and down that lineup right now. There's a reason they slid back as much as they have.
Yeah, I'll be really curious to see how they attack the draft, just given that this year their org has been one of the more pitcher heavy farm systems in the game, and that just top end pitching talent plus the depth of arms they have has always been pretty obvious with Pittsburgh. I think there's an interesting argument to make about building your farm system around pitching or building around bats. It feels like a lot of people would prefer to build around bats just because that player demographic seems safer, seems less risky. But the fact that you are an organization without an ownership group that seemingly is willing to spend at the top of the market or even anywhere close to the top of the market, like if you want to get an ace or frontline arm, drafting and developing or signing from the international market and developing is really your only shot to do that. And I think that that specific role on a team, a true front end starting pitcher, is probably the toughest commodity in baseball to find. So really going extremely aggressively there and trying to find that, obviously the Paul Skenes pick, like debating Skenes versus a Cruz or a Langford in the 2023 class. I wonder how much of the decision outside of like, do we think Skenes is purely the best prospect available here, was revolving around just how challenging it is to find that and to get that sort of player in Pittsburgh. And when you have a generational pitching prospect, maybe that was just too rare a commodity to pass up.
I mean, I don't even know that they've really built around pitching. It just has sort of worked out that they've ended up with better pitching prospects maybe than hitters. I mean, they went with Henry Davis 1-1.
Is that a credit to the pitching development group, or maybe a sign that you haven't gotten quite as much of out of the hitters that you've put in the system as you would have liked, or both?
Probably a little of both. I mean, like, okay, like you drafted Paul Skenes. Like, I don't know that they would take or deserve any credit for like their development of Paul Skenes. He just sort of came in being awesome. So that's a big part of it. With Jared Jones, they've certainly, you know, done a good job of, I think, maximizing his development. But I think on the hitter side, whether it's, you know, the players they've picked or the development, either way, I don't think you can be happy really with where the state of their position prospects are right now. I mean, it's interesting to go back and look at that 2021 draft where they did take Henry Davis, where, you know, second overall was Jack Leiter. Third overall, Rangers took Jackson Job. Fourth overall, Red Sox took Marcelo Meyer. Fifth overall, Colton Cowser to the Orioles. Sixth overall, Jordan Lawler to the D-backs. So no sure things, or nobody who's like totally jumped out and established themselves. And I think Leiter has certainly been disappointing relative to the expectations, maybe starting to turn things around right now. Like, I think he could still end up being a solid back end starter potentially, but who would you rather have out of all of those six guys? I might put Davis last on that list right now. I would.
Yeah. I mean, I probably would too. It's not totally shocking. I mean, we did have Davis ranked 5 out of that top 5 group back in 2021. I believe it was Jordan Lawler, Marcelo Meyer, Jack Leiter, Kamar Rocker, then Henry Davis, I believe was our order.
Yeah, that was the year Rocker went to 10, and we were like, why is Rocker going that?
So yeah, the fact that Colton Cowser's in there, I think good on the Orioles. We've talked about that enough, but I think you're probably right. I might I don't know if I'm totally convinced that Jack Leiter is back enough. Maybe I would have to look at Henry Davis and Jack Leiter a little bit, but certainly guys like Jobe, Meyer, Lawler, I'd probably rather take a shot on them at this stage. And then also, like, looking at Pittsburgh's entire draft that year, just the money they saved to get players like Anthony Solomito, Lonnie White, Bubba Chandler, $2.8 million, $1.5 million, $3 million specifically. They certainly had a strategy there of underslotting Davis. He had the, I mean, his signing bonus stands out as a significant money saver there compared to all these other five players at the top end. I guess Kowser maybe not including in that conversation, given where he was at on the board. But yeah, I mean, Anthony Solomito has been good. Bubba Chandler has been good. Lonnie White, I think, had some hit risk at the time. Not sure what you would say about all of those players, but a clear strategy to take the portfolio approach, take college hitter, and then spread money around to some high upside preps.
Yeah, I mean, Chandler's been good. Solomito's been solid. Maybe not quite. I think the stuff's a little bit lighter than you'd like it to be at this point. I mean, it's the performance, certainly through the lower levels of the minors, has been good. But I mean, in just in terms of the, you know, this year, obviously it hasn't been great in Double A. And then just like you look at the overall value of that draft compared to, or just kind of the hitters they have overall in the system, like I think that's one of the reasons why this, I mean, taking Davis 1-1 and then taking that approach where, you know, hopefully Bubba Chandler works out. But again, like, even if you took one of those other bats at one, and look, I love Jack Leiter, so like maybe I would have taken him one overall, and it obviously hasn't worked out well for Texas with that pick either. But like, even if you had taken one of those other hitters there, who we had ranked above Davis going into the draft, like it's not like you're just totally punting on your second and your third round picks either. Like, you still could have gotten good players there. So it's not like Henry Davis and Solomito, White and Chandler, or just say Colton Cowser or just Jordan Lawler, and then nothing else with those picks either.
Definitely. It's not a, yeah, I imagine it would have been a lot trickier to get the Chandler deal done, just given his signing, if they were to go with like a Jordan Lawler or Marcelo Meyer, just assuming their bonuses would have stayed similar if they were taken in that spot. But just really quickly, Lonnie White threw 16 games in high A with Greensboro. He's hitting just 200, 278, 492. Anthony Solomito actually has walked quite a bit more batters than you typically see from him so far in his time at Double A, second stint in Double A this year. After 12 starts a year ago at that level, he's repeating. He's got a 5.06 ERA through 16 innings, 14 strikeouts, 11 walks. So it'll be interesting to see if he's able to get those numbers back down to his more normal 3.5 range. And then Bubba Chandler, also in Double A, he's got a 3.10 ERA through 5 starts, 20 innings, a little bit better strikeout and walk numbers, 23 punchouts, 10 walks. So it's kind of how those guys are doing so far this year. It'll be very fascinating to see what route the Pirates go with the number 9 overall pick in this year's draft. I have to imagine a lot of hitters will be available on the board. I kind of want them to add a hitter just to infuse some of that demographic into their farm system. And like you were talking about, the lineup does need a lot of work there. So that'll be fascinating.
The one other guy, I don't know if we really moved him. Actually, I don't even know if we moved him at all. But maybe we need to think about doing it next time, is Dalton Rushing with the Dodgers, who just looks like an extremely complete hitter right now. So he's hitting 290, 412, 551 in Double A. He's hitting for power. He is not swinging and missing much, and he's not chasing much outside the strike zone. Really very few holes right now to poke in the offensive game from what he's shown so far. It's again, low swing and miss, low chase and plus power. I know there's questions on like the defense, like will he stay at catcher? I think it's been a little bit better this year. The problem obviously is like, I hope he doesn't turn into Michael Bush 2.0 mm-hmm. and just stick around in AAA for the Dodgers for like multiple seasons, because they don't have a place for him with Will Smith behind the plate, or obviously Freddie Freeman, Otani. Like, there's not an obvious place for him to play in Los Angeles in the near future. And I think he'd be a very, very attractive trade chip that I'm sure other teams are keeping an eye on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Dalton Rushing was one of the more exciting up arrow guys coming out of the draft in 2022. I think we actually had him linked to the Dodgers in that draft at the time. But the bat was always really exciting. He actually got a little bit more time to catch that year, and so raised his draft stock, just in addition to his great offensive season, with a bit more skill shown behind the plate. Like you said, his combination of contact, swing decisions, power has been encouraging. The walk rate has never been lower than 14%, which is what it's at this year in his first look at AA. He is a little bit older, 23, not like the extreme age of Michael Bush in the realm of prospects, at least when I'm talking about extreme age. But yeah, as soon as he started talking about him, I kind of wondered if he was going to be another player who just became a bit of a victim of the fact that the Dodgers don't have any holes. And I would like to see him pushed aggressively, just because you look and you see that 15% chase rate, his end zone miss rate is really good as well. Just everything about the offensive profile looks pretty polished and exciting. And even if he does have to move off catcher, I think he could still be a valuable player, though I am encouraged to hear just the positive feedback that you've been getting, maybe at least a little bit of it so far this year, because that offensive profile is obviously much more appealing at the catcher position. But he just feels like a pretty well-rounded hitter, and I know coming into the year was a guy that some people on staff liked quite a bit better than even Michael Bush, even if that wasn't consensus opinion. So good on Dalton Rushing for continuing to keep it up.
Yeah, I don't want to like overstate the defensive progress or anything like that. He's only been, I think, like 9 or 10 games behind the plate this year, but I think just especially the offensive side. I mean, he's cut his strikeout rate from 24% last year to 18% this year. Like you said, super low swing and miss on pitches in the zone, and that's usually what he's swinging at. He's not chasing much outside the zone, and then you have the plus power to go with it. So like, I don't know, I think this guy has a chance to be high on base with, you know, maybe depending where he, like if he's catching, maybe he's just won't play as many games, but you know, if he's playing a full season, 25 plus home runs, if you move him off catcher, put him at like first base DH, I could see him being a 30 plus home run guy in certain seasons too. So because he does swing, he gets good pitches to hit, and then when he does, he hits it in the air, and he hits it with, you know, plus EVs too.
Yeah, he's currently hitting the ball in the air more than 50% of the time, which is a really high rate. That's encouraging for a guy with his sort of power. It's a 20% line drive rate, 26% ground ball rate, and 54% fly ball rate overall. It's actually the highest fly ball rate he's had in the minors too. And if I remember correctly, Dalton Rushing was a player who basically, as soon as he got into pro ball, the feedback he was getting from pro scouts was really encouraging, and people were basically like, yeah, if we had to redo the draft like 2 months after it, he would have been a first rounder. And here the Dodgers are getting him with the 40th overall pick. So another example of the Dodgers just having pretty savvy decision-making ability in the draft while picking behind everyone else.
Yeah, he went out that year and he hit like 400 and slugged about 800. I mean, a college guy in low A, but still, that was a pretty loud debut. Like you said, everybody was saying, oh, they got another good one.
Yeah. Let's see here. I've got a couple other players that I wanted to bring up with you, and maybe I'll jump to Lázaro Montes with the Mariners. I don't know if he had any significant movement on the top 100, but when you mentioned Dalton Rushing's just improvement in strikeout rate, that's also something I noticed with Montes. And entering the year, He was coming off a season in low A in the complex where the strikeout rate was about 25%. Previously in the DSL as a 17-year-old at a 33% rate. So far this year in low A, it's again, he's 19 years old in low A. That rate is from 25% all the way down to 14.6%. He's hitting .311, .425, .553 with six homers. How encouraged are you with him cutting that strikeout rate, and does that at all change his profile for you? Because for me, that was a pretty significant improvement. And again, I think we're well into the territory of being able to make some decisions based on those changes. Like, it's 123 plate appearances. I think it's more than enough to see at least some sort of approach change with Montas.
Yeah, I think he's going to be another guy who moves up in our next update. I've been a big time fan of his ever since he came out of Cuba. I mean, I like the swing. It's a huge, huge physical monster with power to match. The swing and miss was a lot higher than I actually expected his first year out in the DSL. He was able to cut that down last year. I think even early on this season, he got even maybe a little bit too contact oriented, because I think he did consciously want to put more balls in play, lower the strikeout rate. He doesn't have to sell out to be able to generate that power, because he has so much bat speed, he has so much strength to be able to drive the ball out to all parts of the field. But early on, he really wasn't hitting for a lot of power. But I think he's kind of adjusted that approach to find really a happy medium between contact and power. I think the swing itself is not a ton different maybe from what it was when he signed. I mean, maybe the way he's loading his hands has gotten a little bit more condensed from maybe last year even, but I think it's just the approach is better now. The swing decisions have been significantly improved. I mean, he always drew walks too, but I think now the approach, the pitches that he's swinging at have gotten better, which I mean, he looks like a very complete hitter now. You look at the last week or so, he already has three home runs. So not that I think anybody questioned that this guy has monster power, but you know, maybe early in the season when it was strangely a little bit more contact oriented, now you're seeing him find that balance between contact and impact. And it's like, all right, I mean, you know, we have what, Xavier Isaac, I think in the 50s on our top 100, like who would you rather have? Like Xavier Isaac, who I maybe not to a great start this year, I still like him, but I don't know, I think it's at least pretty close, very debatable between the two. Not a whole lot of defensive value with either guy, but I mean, I think Montas has the chance to be that 30 plus home run middle of the lineup type masher.
Yeah, and I think it's just exciting to see that he's able to make some of those adjustments, even if he's still trying to find like the perfect blend of contact versus power. Just some players don't seem to show the ability to make an adjustment, even if they know it's something that's necessary. I mean, if you look at his overall exit velocity numbers now compared to a year ago, the exit velocities are a little bit down for Montas. But like you said, if he's starting to reclaim that balance, I'll be curious to see if it just ticks up and we get to more of the sort of impact he showed a year ago in the batted ball data. Like you said, he doesn't chase too much. Those numbers have been good to see, and it also hasn't come from him just being more passive at the plate overall. The swing rate, I actually think, is a little bit up from what he was doing a year ago. So it just seems like higher quality swing decisions, maybe just higher quality contact skills that he's showing, which is really encouraging for a player that has the sort of power potential that you're talking about.
Yeah, and it may be like an adjustment that he has to continually go through up through the, as he gets through higher levels in the minor leagues. Like if James Wood, who we mentioned and who he just moved up to be the Nationals' number one and number five prospect in baseball, and a couple guys ahead of him will probably Langford, unfortunately, will not be graduating just because of the injury imminently, but you know, Jackson Churia will graduate. So James Wood, he may end up the number one prospect in baseball at some point this year, but even right now, as good as he's been and as impressive as his drop in strikeout rate has been, he does only have two home runs this year. So I think, but then again, like you look at the exit velocity numbers for James Wood. And it's like, okay, he's hitting the ball up to what, like 115 miles an hour this year. Like this guy has what, 70, 80 raw power probably. Yeah. So there's no question about his raw power. It's just not maybe translating into the home run numbers. I think he maybe is a little bit more focused just on putting the ball in play right now. But again, like I don't have much doubt that he's going to find that happy medium and balance between the two, and another guy who could be, I mean, 30, talking about, he could be a potential 40 home run guy. And it would, I don't know, it wouldn't stun me at all if he ended up having a 50 home run season in there too.
Yeah, Wood's exit velocity numbers are quite a bit more impressive than most of the players that we've talked about so far on this podcast today. Like you mentioned, top end EV is up to 115. His 90th percentile mark is right around 110 miles per hour, which is a pretty impressive rate and unsurprising considering just the frame and the size and the bat speed and the strength you see with the swing. So I would be right there with you as someone who is probably not too concerned with just home run output for James Wood. I mean, this is a guy who's hit double digit homers in the minors before. He hit 18 at Double A last year in 87 games. I think, like you said, hitters, you kind of have to go through this back and forth of trying to maximize your approach, trying to thread the needle of what's too much contact, what's too much power in terms of like swing decisions and intent at the plate. It's a delicate balance that you kind of always have to be on top of. So I think that's a really good point, Ben. Anything more on Montes? I got one other player who maybe doesn't even fit with these other big sluggers I'm talking about, but was an up arrow guy and is fascinating as well.
Who's your slappy hitting contact guy you're looking at?
The slappy hitting contact guy I'm looking at is Athletics shortstop Jacob Wilson, who has pretty strong overall numbers. Also moved up about 20 spots on our update, going from 67 to 48. And I would say has pretty elite bat-to-ball skills. Jacob Wilson right now is hitting 455, 473, 705, three home runs. Jacob Wilson, more home runs than James Wood. How about that? 2.2% walk rate, 10.8% strikeout rate, and just ludicrous pure contact skills, end zone miss rates, despite maybe a little bit more of an aggressive approach than I would have expected. So what are your thoughts on Jacob Wilson, and what was the process in the room and moving him up? Because I guess the contact skills that he's showing aren't super surprising given he was maybe the best pure contact bat in his draft class. But I was encouraged to see him putting up these sorts of numbers in Double A.
Oh yeah. The swing and miss rate looks like, especially on stuff in the zone. Cause like you said, he does chase quite a bit, or he has at least been chasing quite a bit this season, which is why I've only seen him walk twice. But then when a pitch is in the zone, his plate coverage is even beyond plate coverage on some of the pitches he's swinging. Yeah, like I think maybe that's
Madrigal-esque.
Yeah, I mean that's part of like the like gift and curse that he has, the hand-eye coordination where he can put the bat to the ball on pitches that are either outside the zone or borderline strikes that like he probably should, or he really should not be swinging at. But like again, he's hitting 455, 473, 705. It's working for him. I do think, obviously, I like Jacob Wilson and I love his back control, but Midland, where he's playing, is a very good hitter's park. So I think there is some air still in those numbers. There still is very little power in there right now. Like if you look at the exit velocities, like I think his 90th percentile exit velocity right now is
98.
Yeah, so it's still toward the lower end of guys who are top prospects. Like it's again kind of more in line with like the lighter, slappier hitting guys. So I think there is some Midland effect that's propping up his numbers to a certain extent, but it's hard to perform much better than he has. I mean, even going back to last year, and obviously love the ability to make contact with whatever pitch it is and whatever part of the strike zone.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you entirely there. His home run to fly ball rate is almost four times what it was in 2023 in high A in about 23 games. So he's basically at the same sample of total games in double A. The home run to fly ball rate was 4.8% in this previous sample, and it's currently 16.7%. He's actually even hitting the ball in the air less often. I shouldn't say that. He's hitting fly balls less often. He's actually hitting more balls on a line. But yeah, I wouldn't expect him to be much of a power hitter at all. I don't think that was ever part of his game. I am curious to see how the walk rate or the selectivity or the swing decisions progress, because I think it's going to be very hard to be an above average hitter, even with this sort of elite contact rate in the bigs, if he's not walking and he's not hitting for power. Like, what do you think the upside of him just as a pure hitter is if he's not walking a little bit more than he is now?
I mean, like maybe the guy, the Marlins just traded Luis Arias. Like, I think the contact skills could be potentially that good. I mean, he rarely swings and misses. We're obviously, you know, it's one thing to do that in college. Now he's facing guys in double A and it's still the same. But yeah, for a guy who you don't expect to hit for much power, the value is going to have to come from, you know, combination of the defense, but then obviously offensively, the on-base skills is going to be paramount for him. So I think it really would benefit him to just become a more selective hitter and maximize, you know, draw more walks, get on base that way to complement the kind of the pure hitting skills that he does have. So, but obviously easier to just say that than to, you know, be able to implement those changes.
Yeah. The miss rate overall is actually pretty similar to what Luis Arias is doing right now this year. I think it's 11% miss rate for Jacob Wilson, and Luis Arias is right around 9.3%. So, he has been an above average hitter throughout his career while having basically no extra on base value, just tied directly to walks and very little power, only one season in 2023 where he had double digit homers. So I guess we can pivot to that trade. We haven't talked about that yet, Ben, but we can kind of break down the Luis Arias trade, get our thoughts on it. I'll just throw it to you first. What were your thoughts on this trade when it happened? And what are your thoughts on the haul that the Marlins had got back? It was Luis Arias for Dylan Head, Jacob Marcy, Nathan Martorella, and Woosuk Go. What are your thoughts?
Not much of a haul to me.
Interesting. I'm glad you say that, because we're going to have different opinions on this trade, I think.
So you're not getting a top 100 prospect. You're not really getting anybody who I think was even in consideration for being a top 100 guy. Probably the closest would be Dylan Head, who was the Padres' first round pick at the back of the first round last year. I thought it was a light return for the Marlins. And then it turned out that the Marlins were actually going to pay down, I think, the rest of Arias' contract for this year. So they're putting in even more money, I guess, under the theory that this somehow would result in a better prospect return, which I don't know. I don't see a better prospect return. Like, I guess this was the enhanced package that they got, but, you know, I like Dylan Head, 70 runner, center fielder, liked his bat coming out of the draft, back of the first round guy, probably would have taken him a little bit after that if it were me, but okay, like good player. Not a big power guy, maybe some sneaky pop here and there, but this year it's been a little bit more swing and miss than I would have expected. That's concerning. And then the rest of the trade package, like I don't really see a standout from that group either. So for 2 years of Luis Arias, who, yeah, like, all right, I get it. He's, you know, some people are going to maybe overinflate his value just because of the batting titles attached to his name. But this is still a guy who's in the prime years of his career, who's been a however you want to measure it, 3-win, 4+ win player. Last year, the last couple of years, premium bat control, gets on base, obviously doesn't have a huge amount of power or a ton of defensive value either, but this is still a really good player under team control for 2 years. And especially if you're going to pay down the contract for that, the rest of the season, I think you got to get a better package than this. I mean, I guess the steel man would be you think this is the best trade offer you're going to get for Arias. The Padres have the most interest. There's no guarantee that the Padres are going to be, looking to add at the trade deadline. Maybe they slide back and they end up being sellers and you don't have another team coming with a better offer at the deadline. But I certainly don't see this deal as some, oh my God, we can't wait until the trade deadline. We have to take this deal to get, Dylan Head and Jacob Marcy and Nathan Martorella.
Okay. Well, let me give you my thoughts on the trade, because I think I have a little bit different opinion on it. And I basically think that Luis Arraez is probably already past his peak. I think his 2023 season, there's a pretty good chance that that's the best he ever is at the major league level. I think this trade is maybe more representative of his actual value than people want to think. The averages are really loud and the hit tool is pretty impressive, but he's also a pure contact, no walks, no power, left-handed hitting, bad second baseman and first baseman who is probably going to be DHing a lot in this lineup. So, I mean, how valuable is that really? Yeah, he had a 130 WRC plus in 23 and 22, but again, I think those are probably going to wind up being his peak seasons. He's already lost a significant amount of exit velocity year over year. In 2023, he averaged 88 miles per hour. This year, it's 2 ticks down at 86. He had a really scorching start in the 2023 season and really hasn't been anywhere close to that in 2024 so far, just in terms of overall offensive ability. So I just think, I don't know how you could ever expect really to get a huge prospect haul for a guy like this who you only have 2 years of control. He's not giving you great defensive value. He can't even really play an up the middle position at a high level or even an average level. So I just think my thoughts on Luis Arraez as a player are probably quite a bit lower than yours. And I think I probably expected you to have less of a thought on him as a player. I think he's a fine player, but I think he's more of a solid regular or a tick below at this stage, considering where he's going to be playing. And so for that, I think the Marlins added a very good prospect in Dylan Head, two guys who I think are intriguing in Marcy and Martorella, and maybe more of a flyer with Go. But I actually think this is a perfectly fair return for him. Yeah, there's a chance that Dylan Head never becomes the sort of player that Luis Arraez is in the big leagues, but I also think his upside is a bit higher, just given his speed, given his defensive ability, and also given the batted ball quality we saw with him in his debut in 2023. I do think you're right, his 2024 showing has not been superlative. There are probably still going to be some pure hit questions and power questions. But I just think it's a fair package coming back and one that could potentially help both teams. It seems the Padres maybe need another lefty stick that can be reliable. Arraez feels like he can be that guy for at least this year. But I would be very concerned about what Luis Arraez looks like as a player in the 2025 season. I would not be very optimistic about it.
I don't know. He had a 130 OPS plus the last 2 years. He's still 27 years old this year. I mean, he's never been a big EV guy. It's just he kind of breaks the brains maybe of people looking at the sliders on Baseball Savant, and you'd think he'd be a low value player, but he's just so preternaturally gifted in terms of his hand-eye coordination, his bat-to-ball skills, that he's able to make it work even without power. I mean, it's not I guess he's primarily a singles hitter. He still had 30 doubles and 10 home runs last year.
But it's even then, 20, I don't know, I just expect him to be more like the 2021 version of himself, which is like a fine player, but more, a lot closer to like fringy than like above average regular.
You think he's more like a, well, I guess it depends which, well, like you think he's like a 2-win type player or below that? Yeah,
I would think he'd be much more in the like 1-2 win sort of range of a player at this point. I would not bet on him being a 3+4 player moving forward.
All right. So then, we definitely disagree on that part. I think the return, and then I think the return for him is like, I just don't know why you don't wait. Cause maybe he does end up being that, you know, like you said, maybe a 1-2 win type player, and then you trade him at the deadline, and is your return going to be any different than what you got? I would hold on to him. I think there's going to be more teams.
More likely that his trade value decreases as we get closer to the deadline, I would say. You get less control, and if, like, because I'm bearish on him moving forward, I wouldn't expect him to have, like, a spurt that reminds you of 2023. So I would expect, like, the fact that you just have less time with him to decrease the value of the trade.
Right. So that, but then that's because you think he's, I guess you're just lower on Arias as a player than I am. Yeah. See, I think you wait until the trade deadline. I think his value I think you have more teams that are just going to want to upgrade their lineup at some spot, and he would be able to be an upgrade for teams in the lineup somewhere, and you can get, you know, maybe there's like limited options if the Padres are your only trade partner, just because the Padres have traded away so many players, and like, they're not going to give you Ethan Salas. Like, they're probably not going to give up Robbie Snelling in this deal. And then like, are they going to give up Leo DeVries at this point? Like, I don't know.
Luis Arraez? That seems crazy.
He's like a back of the... I like DeVries, but like, he's a back of the top 100 prospect for somebody who...
Again, I would much rather have DeVries than Arraez, I think. I think Arraez might be one of the more overrated players in baseball just because of the average. Like, I saw people replying in our Instagram comments about the trade, talking about him as one of the most valuable hitters just because he's a two-time batting champ. I'm sorry, but we have to do more than that at this stage. I think that's insane to me.
I mean, so if you just look at his, you know, OPS or WRC plus, like, that's still been a pretty valuable
hitter. Yeah, it has
over the last 2 years.
You could say for 2 years he's been a well above average hitter. Outside of that, I don't know that you can really claim that too confidently. He's had a bunch of partial
seasons. I mean, when he was like 24, 23, like, these guys come up and they're rookies when they're
that age. I'm just not expecting a season better than 22, 23 for Luis Arraez moving forward.
Yeah. Are you big on any of these prospects
that they got back? I think that Marcy actually does a lot of things pretty well. And hearing how, like, optimistically people like Jeff talk about him, I think that maybe he could be an intriguing player. I don't expect him to be some sort of impact regular, but I think he could be a useful big leaguer. Martorella, a little more skeptical just given the profile, but I am pretty excited about Dylan Head. I think he has tools. He's got defensive skill. He's got bat speed. He's young. He's clearly the headliner of this deal. And I guess how excited you are about the package, one, obviously depends on where you're at on Arraez. If you're where I am or where you're at or somewhere in between. And also, like, how much conviction do you have in Head becoming an average hitter, I think is really key for his profile. So, but I am, I would say I'm pretty excited about Dylan Head. Like, he would have been a player who I would have started thinking about as like a fringe top 100 type had he had the performance early this year. I don't think he's done that yet. But I think the athlete and the tool set is really exciting to me.
I think the offensive game has been, I think that's lowered his value, just some of the swing and miss that he's shown. Swing and miss, chase, like, for a guy too who's already not been a, you know, I don't think we ever expected him to be a big power guy. Like, that's been a concern for me. And I still think he's a good prospect, but I don't think he should be the guy who should be the headliner of a deal like this.
Yeah.
Well, I'll go C- at best.
I think I like this one. I think it can be good. I don't hate this for the Padres. Like, they're clearly getting a player they can plug into their lineup now and provide value. I just think that the deal seems fair to me because, I just don't have the same expectations for Arise moving forward that you do.
Do you think the Padres will regret moving any of these guys?
No, because the Padres are going to restock that farm system pretty immediately, I think. And they didn't get rid of any of their primo guys. Like, I mean, there's always a chance we look up in 5 years and Dylan Head is a star. But no, I mean, I don't think so. I think it's perfectly fair trade and doesn't really change my overall thoughts on the Padres as an org or as a – they're like org talent rankings. Like, yeah, they do lose some depth here, but they still have enough top end guys to keep me excited about the system. And again, a year from now, there are probably going to be a number of other players who are in their system that we're really excited about as well. So
I did see people saying, oh, like, I can't believe the Marlins traded Arias, but like, no, they definitely need to trade him at some point this year.
They clearly need to tear it all down. Like, you know who really comes out as the winners in this trade is the Twins.
Well,
Pablo Lopez trade is looking great.
Yeah. Marlins traded. So they traded Lopez. They get two very good years. Well, maybe we'll disagree on that for Arias. And then
No. I do think his last 2 years were very good. I just think that's the
peak. Just now, this year.
We're going downhill now.
All of a sudden in his age 27 season, he's fallen off the table.
Yes.
But yeah, I think the Twins are pretty happy with that one.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else you want to touch on before we get into some listener questions, Ben?
Yeah. Can we talk about somebody who does have power again?
Yeah, let's do it.
Junior Caminero is just hitting balls. He hit a baseball. Dude, this ball was nowhere near the strike zone. It was a 1-2. Yeah, it was a 1-2 fastball. At like his shoulders and like maybe like on the chalk of the left-handed hitter's batter's box, and he just swung at it, launched it out right field. This guy has, you know, Rays infielder monster power, number 3 in our top 100 right now. I can't wait till he comes back up again.
Yeah, no, I didn't see the home run you're talking about. I'm going to look it up as soon as we get off this podcast, though. But why is Junior Caminero not the number one prospect? I mean, Jackson Holliday went up to the majors and did not look very good. Junior Caminero, we love him. He hasn't been exposed at the majors and underperformed. So, I mean, do you think the conversation between – I mean, we had him 3. I think we had him in the elite tier entering the year. Do you think the conversation between Junior and Jackson Chourio, Jackson Holliday – is closer now, just given performance, or are all the profiles still pretty similar and you're just excited about him in general? I mean, he's hitting 315, 375, 630, 6 homers, 5 doubles in 18 games with AAA Durham right now.
Yeah, I mean, Jackson Holliday's been really good in AAA too. So, and it's not like Caminero lit it up last year when he was in the big leagues. No, I'm not like any down on Jackson Holliday. Really at all. I obviously am surprised he struggled to the extent that he did, but no, I'm just excited about Junior Caminero. I think he has, I mean, 80 raw power on the 2080 scale, just the way he's,
yeah.
I mean, he can hit a ball out with ease to all fields, just absolutely electric bat speed. I hit 31 home runs last year. I think he's going to do that. I think he's going to be a 30 to 40 plus home run guy in some seasons mm-hmm. when he gets the big leagues, he's playing all third base, I should say, this year. I think that's really the best fit for him defensively. I think he's just going to be somebody who, settles in at third base, hits in the middle of the lineup, is a, you know, that 30 plus home run type guy. I mean, certainly more of an aggressive approach than the Holliday or some other guys we have toward the, you know, in our top 10 right now, but very few guys in, you know, whether it's in the minor leagues or in the major leagues that have this guy's power. And again, he's still 20 years old for another couple months.
Yeah, so he's basically like a year plus younger than James Wood. And I'm curious how much separation you view between them, because I think it's an interesting conversation. I believe these two guys would be maybe some of the most exciting pure power hitters on our prospect list. It's 3 and 5 on the board, so there's not a ton of separation. I would view the age and the infield ability for Caminero as two prominent factors in his for his case, and then the left-handed hitting ability and the speed of James Wood are maybe two areas you could look at if you really wanted to make the James Wood case. But both of them are really fascinating players who I think we both expect to be kind of in contention to lead the majors and homers in their peak seasons.
Yeah, a little bit more consistent offensive track record too with Caminero, and more consistently getting to that power in games. So I would give Caminero the slight edge right now, but I mean, Jackson Churio will probably graduate in the next couple months. So like, we're talking about two guys who'll be the number, 2 and 4 prospects in baseball mm-hmm. at that point. And Langford, I'm so pissed he got hurt, because once guys are like in the big leagues for like 130 at bats is the cutoff, and that's the same for rookie eligibility plus the service time. But I almost wish sometimes it could be like 100 at bats, because at a certain point you're like, all right, these guys aren't really, they don't really feel like prospects anymore mm-hmm. at this point. Let's clear these guys out and put some minor leaguers on this list.
Yeah. I guess wherever you had the cutoff, you'd run into those issues, but it definitely feels like he's not a prospect at this point, which feels crazy to say.
Yeah. But I mean, that was one of the things we talked about in the, you know, top 100 process, was like, all right, reevaluating like Wood versus Cruz, right? And then Wood versus then Wood versus Langford, and you know, reevaluating Langford, Skeens, and Cruz again. Like, Cruz obviously off to like the slowest start of all those guys, but I mean, for the most part, it was really those first couple games that like were pretty bad stinkers for Cruz that he had, which you can't just say, oh, like if you took away his worst games, he'd be doing this, but more just like to show how small still it is of a sample size. Like if you did take away those first two games, like I think his OPS would be like 850 or something mm-hmm. right now. Like he's still hitting the ball really hard. Like there's still contact skills there. Like all the stuff you look for is there. I think it's just been maybe a slow start to the first, especially that first series of the year for him.
It really is kind of crazy. If you take away two games, the OPS jumps by a significant amount. You weren't lying or being like hyperbolic when you said that.
That's not me, Carlos.
Yeah. Let me actually see. So what's his overall OPS this year in AA?
For Dylan Cruz?
For Dylan Cruz. Yeah. Do you have that? I can get it in 2 seconds. So in his 17 games, his OPS is 771. And like you said, if you just take away two games, so that's an 0-for-5 day with 4 punch outs, then an 0-for-3 day, and you just count the 15 games after that, you're looking at an 863 OPS, and all of a sudden there is no narrative about Dylan Cruz struggling or being hitting slowly. He's just having a fine season, which is funny.
Yeah, and again, it's not like, oh, we could do that with everybody, right? Mm. But it is more just, yeah, this to talk about the sample sizes. That's why we didn't really move him.
We get back to the anchoring, too. It's very easy to, like, if someone started off really hot and then cooled down and had those two games at the last stretch and they had identical numbers, just how you think about that player's season is so different, and you have to be really aware of that.
Yeah, you look at some of the stuff, too, where, okay, he's hitting the ball up to 114 this year. It's not super high swing and miss or chase either. So like the components that you're looking for and that you expect to see from Dylan Cruz as a hitter are still there. Whereas with other guys, where, hey, like this guy's swing and miss rate is way up, or his chase rate is way up, or, you know, something in the exit velocity data or something else you see where it's a lot more tangible or stabilizes more quickly in a smaller sample size, yeah, then we'll move guys around more. But in Cruz's case, I think it was, you know, and we may end up moving him down in another update just once we have more, a little bit more sample size with him.
Not if I have any say about it.
True, true. But at this point, I think the thought was, all right, well, you know, there was a little bit of thought of like moving him down a couple more spots, but I don't know. Then like you look at the guys behind him and it's not like, I don't know, it's not like Jordan Lawler's taken off or done anything to raise his stock, or like Ethan Salas or Basayo, you know, with the Orioles this year. So I think we, for the most part, I guess we flipped Skeens ahead of him, but and obviously Wood too, but it's really more those two guys just taking off than anything else.
Oh, that all makes sense. All right, cool. Listener questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we've got one directed for you, Ben, from Devin on Twitter, who asked, I'd love to hear your thoughts on Braylor Guerrero. I just have Braylor Guerrero's page up here. But he is off to a hot start with the Rays. People want to know more about him. Rays outfielder, currently in the FCL. He played in the DSL last year. He doesn't really have a huge sample of games, but I guess his early games have been pretty loud. So some Rays fans might be curious to hear your thoughts on him.
Yeah, big international signing for the Rays, 2 years ago now, out of the Dominican Republic. Just very strong, physical, left-handed hitter, monster power, probably, I mean, conservatively plus raw power. He could go double plus raw power on it. It's definitely power over pure hit with him. Like he hasn't played in a ton of games yet, either this year or
It's just three games so far this year, seven games last
year. He had a shoulder injury, so he didn't get a lot of DSL games last year, but one of the biggest power bats in the class, kind of to be determined still on how the hit tool ultimately looks. Just really need to see him play in more games before having a lot of confidence in that. But some risks, he just ends up getting so big that he ends up at first base. He's still 18. He's already a pretty big dude, but he's got, he does have a plus arm. He can really throw from right field. He moves around well enough to play out there. It just kind of depends how he develops physically. I think he might still be 17 at this point. He is still 17. He'll turn 18 next month. But yeah, I mean, big, or not like big, like 6'1". He's not like that super tall guy, but really strong physical, plus to plus plus, I would say. I'd probably lean more towards 70 raw power. So, definitely a chance to be a big physical masher, to be determined still, I think, on the pure hitting ability. But I think it'll definitely be a power, power over hit guy.
All right, awesome. We've got another question from Twitter. This is from St. Louis Perfectos. It's also a question we get relatively frequently, I would say. So just probably some confusion about this in general for people that maybe is good to clear up. But it's another question about asking how teams slide players in the draft. They ask, is it mainly a matter of pre-negotiating deals and say, we'll give you X amount of money, but we'll take you later. And then those players then telling other teams they need to beat that amount. How exactly does it work? I know we've kind of run through this before, but it is essentially that, like, if you're, it mostly works with high school players, again, just because they have more leverage, they can go to school, teams are going to want to be really confident about locking down signability numbers with those players. But at any point there can be a player with a deal who another team that's not in that deal can just take him and say, hey, we don't have a deal with you, we're going to draft you, if you don't want to sign, that's fine, but this is the number we'll give you. So that can happen. But yeah, I'd say primarily teams are trying to figure out what the amount is to sign players prior to the draft so they can figure out their boards, figure out their strategies. And yes, the way it works is you'll say, hey, if you're here in this range, we have this amount of money ready for you. And then the players will put out a large signing ask. I'm sure different agencies do it different ways. But essentially, if a team, I would say for most teams and most players, especially at the very top of the draft, there are conversations prior to the pick being made where a number is floated, and it's basically gauges if a player will sign for that number. Again, sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes teams just take players with no call at all and try and figure it out later. But I think most teams want to have that like pretty confident, pretty locked in prior to making it, just to have some more comfort and flexibility with the board. But that's generally how it happens. Ben, I'm not sure if there's anything I left out of that you want to kind of add in or chime in, but that's typically how it works. And there's no guarantees for anyone.
So when you're looking at a player, you know, you say you have the 50th pick in the draft and you're asking a player, hey, will you sign for, like as a team, you would ask the player, hey, would you sign for $2 million with, you know, at number 50 overall if you're here? Is that kind of how part of the conversation would go?
Yeah, typically, especially if a team has already kind of made their pick, knows around the range it's going to take to sign that first player. Then they're like, okay, we're in a position now where we can do an overslot deal. I mean, he follows up and asks about the Pirates draft kind of with another question, but I think that's a good example of this.
Yeah. So then the one, if the player says like, yeah, I will do that. So then you're saying the player or his agent will then tell other teams, hey, don't, you know, my number is what, 3 million or 2.5 million. So they want to give what, some big number, so that some other team doesn't draft them instead and try to sign them for the slot bonus, which might be, you know, a million or, you know, whatever it is there.
That could be the case. And it could also be the case too, where the agency is just floating what the actual number is. If that's 2 million, they're floating it to all kinds of teams. There's a team at 50 who maybe is intrigued by that, but then you get to pick 40 and a team calls while they're on the clock and says, hey, we've got 2 million for you here. Will you take it? And there could be no issues there. So I think it's a lot of moving parts. The agents are trying to give their players the best deals they possibly can. Most of the time that's just numbers. Sometimes it does have to do with organizational fits. And I've heard of situations where players are putting out different signabilities for different teams, whether that's because they're just certain locations they don't want to be or certain player development systems they have a lot of confidence in, or teams who move players more aggressively. Like, there can be a lot of factors there. But yeah, generally I'd say that's how it works. It can vary.
Okay. Is it, so, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of the, basically when you see a player who's going to sign for like either, well, I was going to say overslot or underslot, but even a lot of the slot deals, like a lot of the players at the time they're drafted pretty much already have an agreement in place to sign with that club.
I would say most of the time at the very top of the draft, that's probably how it works. Yeah.
Yeah. Less so with the, what about like the overslot guys later on in the draft? There's still some negotiations, some chances you're taking on rolling the dice there.
Yeah. I'm always kind of interested how the actual details work, because I know that as players are signing and as the official deals start coming in, agents are really trying to figure out how much money is left over in the pool. And I know all the agents are trying to get like all of the overage money that you get by going over 5%. They obviously want all of that to come in their deal. So I'm not sure how much like nickel and diming happens after the fact, but I think generally like the big money, especially if you're taking like high school players, top 10 rounds, but like 3+ rounds, if you're taking those players in that range, typically you have a deal lined up, just because I think it's like 97%+ of players, top 10 rounds, do sign. And so if you're taking a player in that range or like very early on day 3, like in one of the kind of premium 11 to maybe 14 range in the draft, and maybe you can even extend it now that we're in just 20 rounds. But those ranges, when teams are picking players there, you kind of expect the deals to be either agreed upon or the teams feel very confident they have the money to make it happen, just based on knowing what the signability was told prior to the draft. So I would say teams mostly feel pretty confident.
and even a good chunk of that 3% of players who don't sign in, what do you say, the top 10 rounds?
Top 10, yeah.
Yeah, even probably a good portion of those too are some sort of medical issue.
Yep.
Popping up where it's like, oh, well.
Exactly.
Now we got to reorganize.
Exactly, yep. So hopefully that helps clear that question up. Maybe it's a sign that we just need some sort of piece on the site laying this out because the draft is pretty convoluted. But we'll move on to a question from Levi Makovic. Hope I'm pronouncing that right, on Instagram. He asked, what's the difference between command and control? I thought about bringing this up previously. I think you had mentioned it with one of the pitchers we talked about early on. Maybe it's Dylan Lesko. But this is one we talked about a decent amount as well. Ben, I'll let you take this one first.
Yeah, I would say probably the most compact definition is control is throwing strikes. Command is being able to hit your spots within the strike zone. I don't know. I think they're pretty correlated, or pretty highly correlated to me. You're not going to have too often a guy who throws a ton of strikes who's, you know, walking at least like a professional level, like a batter per nine innings who doesn't have good command. And you're also, you know, on the inverse is probably true as well. Like, so I think sometimes we can make too much of the difference between control and command, but I think there are some differences. Been able to just throw strikes, which sometimes can be, you know, an approach issue or an approach factor, whereas command is being more precise and be able to hit the precise spots that you're looking for in the strike zone.
Yeah,
or sometimes out of the zone if you're looking for a chase too.
Yep, I think that's exactly right. I basically just say that if you're looking for control on a pitcher, you can basically just go to like walk rates and get a pretty good idea of a pitcher's control. Whereas with command, that's not really the case, particularly at the college level. I'd say there are a lot of questions about like just hitters' ability to expand the zone in college, and maybe more effectively wild pitchers in college can get away with worse control because they're getting chase pitches. Their pure stuff is so good that it maybe masks some of the control issues they have and isn't reflective in the walk rates. But especially as you move up the competitive ladder, I think that just purely looking at walk rate is basically a one-for-one proxy for control, whereas command, it's like Ben said, like hitting specific spots within the zone or outside of the zone.
And it may be a pitch usage and pitch specific control / command thing too, where if you have a guy who's throwing a million sliders in college, but doesn't have good command of that pitch.
Or the opposite. I would say when you mentioned that one player I thought of immediately was Jonathan Santucci, who I would say has much better slider command than fastball command. And that is one of the questions about his profile. Like when he needs to pitch off the fastball, he often just can't get in the zone or locate it where he needs to. And so he then has to throw the slider more frequently, which causes that pitch to play down at times because he's throwing it so often. But yeah, the difference in command from pitch to pitch is a good point as well. All right, we'll go to our last question for today. This is from RealJZ25 on Instagram, who asks, where does 2025 pitcher Jack Bauer compare to other left-handed pitchers in the class? And this is in reference to Illinois High School lefty Jack Bauer on the 2025 list, Ben, that you have done for us. He ranks number 65 currently on our top overall 2025 draft list.
Yeah, he will be, I mean, I think it's him. I'm trying to think of other, I guess Cruz Schoolcraft from, where's he from? Was he from Oregon or Washington? Let me double check. Yes,
he's from Oregon.
That's right. He's from Oregon. He's a two-way player. Schoolcraft is. He's 6'7", 6'8", basically like a left-handed version of Bryce Eldridge. So kind of to be determined which way, whether he goes more left-handed pitcher or hitter, because I think he can do both. But yeah, after that, I think we have Jack Bauer as the next left-handed pitcher in the class. I think he'll draw a lot of attention right away because he's left-handed. He's, I think, 6'3", still very lanky frame, with a pretty easy delivery, does it without a lot of effort, and he's already up to 95. So I think you can project him to potentially be sitting in the mid-90s one day, touching the upper 90s, just once he naturally packs on some more weight, more strength, throws a fastball up in the zone, has really good feel to spin a slider. I think he's still kind of refining the shape of that pitch, but hasn't thrown his changeup a ton, but the makings of two really good pitches. The delivery is really easy, again, low effort. He's still very lanky and long limbs, still learning to sync up his mechanics and repeat his release point to throw more consistent strikes. I think that'll be the one of the big factors scouts are going to be watching for him this summer, but certainly hits a lot of or checks a lot of boxes you're looking for a young left-handed pitcher. I mean, I don't know that he's like similar to Alex Clemmy necessarily, who the Guardians drafted and paid what I think a couple million dollars to out of a Rhode Island high school last year for one of their top picks, but I could see him kind of going a similar way as a lefty with a, you know, really good build. I would say a much better delivery than Clemmy's, but also could be showing similar kind of high octane stuff, and then monitoring where the strikes are this summer. So yeah, it'll definitely be one of the top end left-handed pitchers to watch in the draft for next year.
Yeah. And if you use our database tool at Baseball America, this is one of the new features of the new site. You can actually filter by position. So if you go to our 2025 draft list, you can look at all the left-handed pitchers filtered out, and you'll see that he is the fifth overall left-handed pitcher in the class behind Cade Fitcher, Cruz Schoolcraft, who you mentioned, Ben on the high school side, who has a pretty elite name, Benebelt, Jamie Arnold, and then Bauer. And you can kind of read into all of these pitchers if you want a more in-depth kind of compare and contrasting of what they're at now.
Yeah, I was talking about second just for high school guys. Yeah, I don't care about I don't care about the college guys. You can.
Yeah, between you and Peter, I get the opposite ends of the spectrum. Peter could care less about the high school players, and you could care less about college. So, but you can get more of the context on the overall class there on our site, or you could just pull up our high school only list if you're like Ben and you don't.
There you go.
College players. If you're not big on academics, go look at just the high school players.
Yeah. We are going to probably have to move him down a spot, though, because Eli Willits, who was number six on our 2026 high school class, just said he's reclassifying for 2025. So he'll be pretty prominent on the list for the 25s for, I guess, this summer, which starting in a month. Carlos, you ready?
No.
No.
No, not at all. We don't even have our 500 done yet for 24. But such is the way of things now that the draft happens in July. So
yeah, I got
you keeping tabs on those guys at this point.
Every scout's favorite change.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all we had for today in terms of questions. Thank you guys again for sending in questions. If you have something you want to send us or an email, you can email us at futureprojection@baseballamerica.com. Ben is on Twitter at Ben Badler. I'm on Twitter at Carlos A. Collazo. But before we hop out entirely, Ben, anything else you want to plug or mention? Then we'll get out of here.
No, we just updated our top 30s on the site for every team. So we're trying to keep those updated throughout the year. Like we said, updated the top 100 too. So a bunch of new updated rankings. You guys have probably already seen it if you're an hour and a half into this podcast already. But if you haven't, we have all those updated on the site now.
Yeah. I don't have too much more to add. Just thanks again for hanging out with us talking baseball, and we'll be back next week for more. So for Ben, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.